Hello, and welcome to our third session, an introduction to human factors, engineers, and patient safety. You'll see this course builds upon the science of patient safety, the session that we did earlier, which outlined those five key principles of recognizing you make mistakes, some basic principles of designing safe systems like standardizing, creating independent checks, and learning when things go wrong, and recognizing teams make wise decisions. Well, we're going to build upon that in this course. And here the objectives are for you to define human factors, engineering, and ergonomics. What are its objectives? What is it used for? And then to give you an introduction to what human factors ergonomics does in healthcare, and particularly for patient safety. Now, what is human factors ergonomics? Well, quite simply, it's the scientific discipline concerned with the understanding of interactions among humans and other elements of a system, and the profession that applies theory, disciplines, data, and methods to design in order to optimize human well-being and overall system performance. In a nutshell, what it means is that it's the study of how humans interact with technologies to make sure that they work well. So what are the goals when we're thinking of this human factors work that we do? Well, first, it's to enhance performance. If you're using a technology, you want to make sure that it's being done what it's going to do to increase safety. And we've seen this enormously when people have introduced information technology, especially physician order entry, into healthcare. And though it defends against some mistakes, it introduces new ones. And to increase user satisfaction. There's no doubt that clinicians or yourself have often been frustrated using some technologies. Perhaps a great example is of, I don't know if any of you have children, but trying to read instructions on putting together children's toys are just so frustrating because they're just not designed to be really read. What human factors engineering, though, isn't, it's not just common sense. It's not just simply using checklist or putting the correct label on. It's much, much more looking at the whole system and how it's designed to enhance performance, efficiency, and safety. And there's a number of domains of human factors ergonomics. The first is physical. That's simply with, based on our human anatomical bodies, how is the layout of the work prone to safety or not safety? You may see that a lot with occupational health and looking to reduce back injuries or carpal tunnel syndrome based on how workstations are designed. The second domain is cognitive ergonomics. And this is something you'll be dealing with a lot in information system. It's trying to understand what are the mental processes, such as perception, memory, reasoning, and motor skills, and looking at how humans interact with technology so that we could defend against mistakes. I think a common example I gave you is that, predictably, when humans are choosing from a list of one out of many, they will make mistakes. Or another great example I've heard of your brain being programmed to make errors. If I ask you to sit to repeat silk, 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 and then ask you the question, what do cows drink? Most people will say milk. Even though cows don't drink milk, they produce milk. But predictably, our brains are wired to make that link between silk and milk. And understanding where we're prone to make mistakes allows you to defend against them. And the third group is organizational ergonomics. And that's really concerned with the optimization of the socio-technology systems in organizations. Looking at policies, procedures, trainings, culture that's created in order to design optimal work areas. So as I mentioned, physical ergonomics, looking at posturing, how we're handling materials, looking at repetitive work environments. There's been a lot of work in trying to reduce back injuries, for example, amongst nurses with moving patients. A lot now when we're having computer workstations in the hospital, looking at workrooms to document on the computer and also prepare medicines. cognitive ergonomics, as I mentioned, is really taking into a deeper load of what's the mental workload? How do we make decisions? And where are we prone to make it go wrong so that we could defend against those mistakes? And here it's a real trade-off, because what we saw in some early decision support tools in healthcare informatics is that when you set alerts for everything, you quickly get people just ignoring them. They get overloaded. They're not feasible. So they ignore them and they lose the potential that they could to defend against it. So trying to find that balance to say, hey, what's critical that I have to make you aware of and what's not so critical is a real key challenge. And finally, organizational ergonomics, what's called macro ergonomics, looks at things like teamwork and an idea called crew resource management that came out from aviation. You may remember my example of that Air Florida crash that the co-pilot was ignored, or the pilot seemingly was deaf. Output of that was training on better teamwork and respect of other workers. Also having clearly defined job descriptions and roles, and importantly, having a culture that allows participatory design, or really tapping into the wisdom of crowds. Now, what's the scope of human factors ergonomics? Well, it's looking at the information display and the machine interaction, and there's going to be a lot that you'll be working with as you design healthcare informatics, thinking about how users are actually going to enter the data, interact with the data, make decisions based on the data, look at the display of the data. All of that, it was in this realm of human factors ergonomics. Second is the environmental interaction. How are the workers interacting with their environment? Where do they have to physically walk to go? Look at this. I'll give you a great example. We put computers on wheels in most of our hospital when we were implementing electronic medical records and physician order entries. And I walked up there one day, and the doctors were complaining that they never used the cows because the batteries were dead. And the health informatics people just said, well, it's just because they forget to plug them in at night. And the doctor said, no, we plug them in and they don't work, or I only have to plug them in, so if I use it, I have a cord running down the hall, which is a trip hazard. So what do? We investigated it. And lo and behold, what we found was that though we routinely scheduled software upgrades, nobody was assigned responsibility for checking how well the batteries held a charge. And now the batteries were 2 years old, and as you know, like many computer batteries, they lose their functioning over time, and they were duds. But we didn't have a system in place to make sure that we checked the batteries for holding charge. Now we do, and it solved a problem. So here on slide 13, just an example of a nurse trying to interact with a computer system. You can see how there's an enormous amount of data displayed, not all of it in the most useful format, frankly. She's standing up, looking away from the patient as she's entering data, not being able to see the patient as she does this. Slide 12 is an amazing example of ergonomics and workflow and the organizational human factors ergonomics. You see, this is a busy emergency department where the patients are written manually on a board of which patient's in which room, what's nurse taking care of them. And you can see it's a bit of chaotic. There's a lot of uncertainty. People have to be able to read that writing. Someone has to keep it updated. A lot of staff are around. Now, what human factors ergonomics, though, is really focused on is understanding why errors happen and reducing their risk. And in thinking about why errors happen, there's what might be called the older approach, the person or the blame approach. And that is when things go wrong, what do? We yell at people. We blame them. We judge their intentions. We criticize them. That is far too often what occurs. We see it. Some parents do it with their kids. We see it in the hospital all the time. What the approach to try to solving that is disciplinary measures, litigation, shaming, blame. It doesn't work. All of those things are anemic. What we've learned from a whole discipline of studying errors is that this systems approach, the approach we talked about earlier in our lesson, is much more effective. And what the systems approach recognizes that there's hazards in our work environment. They're always going to be there. There's nothing we can do about that. We all work under restraints, either cost restraints, time pressures. And when these faults align, then we have a chain of events that allows mistakes to occur. And the countermeasures, the defenses, are based on the assumption that we can't change the human condition, that we're going to be fallible. We will make mistakes, but we will make fewer mistakes if we understand the system. Let me give you this great example. Some of you may have seen it was on Hopkins 24/7. There was a morbidity and mortality conference where the surgeons were reviewing a case where there was a delay in transporting a patient from the operating room up into, from the emergency department up into the operating room. The patient had a gunshot wound and they had to travel 7 floors up from the ED up to the operating room. And they were reviewing why there was a delay. And there was only doctors in the room. Clearly they weren't taking a systems perspective. And a senior doctor was asking a visibly shaking junior doctor. He was literally shaking. He was so scared. What are you going to do differently? And his response was so telling. He said, "I'm going to push harder next time. I'm going to push harder next time." And I watched that and saw how that story typified what is so great about American medicine and what is so naive. Because that doctor, like most people in healthcare, truly believes it's their responsibility to advocate for the patient. They have the weight of the world on their shoulders. And we're fortunate to have doctors and nurses and pharmacists and health informatics people who really, really care. Why it's naive is because it doesn't take a systems approach. It's a personal approach. Behaviorally, when a doctor says, "I'm going to push harder next time," it typically translates into screaming, a tantrum, not likely to be very effective. What would be more effective, perhaps, if we said, "Okay, maybe we'll have the security guard hold the trauma beeper, and when it goes off, their job is just to go get the elevator and don't release it until the trauma surgeon says you're done with it." But we, for the most part, are system blind in healthcare. We don't think in systems, and we need to. So what is a poorly designed system? Well, quite frankly, it's one that doesn't match the needs of the human being working in it or the task they need to accomplish, or it doesn't take into account the limitations of our human fallibility, our perception, our memory. You know, early on when we first put in physician order entry, we often made mistakes where we would start writing electronic orders on a chart that was the wrong person's chart. Someone would open up a different chart. Now when you want to enter an order, we built a safeguard into it that you have to enter the person's initials before you could enter orders to confirm that, yes, this is the chart I want to be working on. Now, what's the systems approach? Well, the systems approach is really based on two relatively simple principles. The first is that these set of circumstances, these hazards, can provoke similar errors regardless of the patient, the people involved. What that means is that the system set us up to make mistakes. Predictably, understandably, I'm going to make mistakes. Just like we outlined in our first example where predictably, I will leave my ATM card behind if I have to put it in and it let go. I let it out of my hand and wait for money back. The second principle is that safety is seriously impeded if an organization does not seek out and remove these error-provoking properties within the system at large. That is, we need to function like safety detectives or hazard detectives. We need to go seek out, identify these hazards, and mitigate the risks. Just like those of you who have toddlers or you have friends who have children who start walking, we go through our house and remove breakables and put up gates at the top of the stairs. We need to go through our work environments and make them safe. What is an error? What's the definition of error? Well, there's a number of definitions, but a common one is the failure of a planned action to be completed as intended or the use of the wrong plan to achieve an aim. Quite frankly, things don't go as the way we intended them to do. And when we think about errors, we often differentiate active failures from latent conditions. What active failures are what we might call the sharp end. That is the interface with the patient, the interface of the operator with the patient where the error occurs. So the nurse who gives the wrong medicine, the doctor who enters the wrong order in a physician order entry. But what underlies those active errors are a whole set of often invisible latent conditions. These are those vulnerabilities I talked about. They're the holes in the Swiss cheese that are opening and closing. And they tend to be removed from the direct control of the operator. I don't control the training. I don't control the options on the physician order entry. I just inherit those, and they set me up for making mistakes. So they create error-prone systems. Or it could be a culture that puts really heavy production pressures to get work done and sets me up to make mistakes. Or that I have long duty hours, so I'm fatigued and I'm bleary-eyed and just can't concentrate. All of these things are setting us up for mistakes. Or there's long-lasting weaknesses and defenses. A classic one in healthcare is alarms. You know, we are inundated in healthcare with alarms. They're just constantly going off. We don't prioritize them. And understandably, clinicians tune out to them. They ignore them, even though embedded within those noises are often a really real signal that says, hey, this patient needs some help. There's something active going on that we often ignore. So let's take a look at a plane crash. An active error is the pilot just when they crash the plane. That's the error. The plane flew into the ground. But the latent errors are there may be a previously undiscovered malfunction in the plane that causes it to roll in an uninspected way that the pilot can't control. And as I mentioned here on slide 19, these latent variables, these latent conditions, are these holes in the Swiss cheese, the defects that we all work with every day. And we're always going to work with them. There's no perfect condition. But when they align, they allow harm to occur. And our job is to take a look at a plane crash. An active error is the pilot just when they crash the plane. That's the error. The plane flew into the ground. But the latent errors are there may be a previously undiscovered malfunction in the plane that causes it to roll in an uninspected way that the pilot can't control. And as I mentioned here on slide 19, these latent variables, these latent conditions, are these holes in the Swiss cheese, the defects that we all work with every day. And we're always going to work with them. There's no perfect condition. But when they align, they allow harm to occur. And our job is to try to plug up those holes. So what's a strategy from error management that we have here on slide 20? Well, first we have to try to limit the errors, eliminate the mistakes if that's possible. We have to make error-tolerant conditions. That is, if I can't prevent the mistakes, if it does occur, could I make the mistake visible? That, oops, I can pick it up, it's more tolerant. Or if I do give you an overdose, the harm is less. So that the three strategies are prevent the errors when you could, make them more tolerant by either making them visible, or thirdly, reduce the harm if the error actually occurs. So it goes on, but I use a lower dose or a less toxic error so that harm actually isn't occurring. And what we see is these high reliability organizations, whether it's an aircraft carrier or a nuclear power plant or a nuclear sub, they're able to carry out exacting tasks under pressure. They have very low error rates, and they do that by good organizational design and management. They have an organizational commitment to safety. They have built in high levels of redundancy that we constantly cross-check each other, and there's no ego where it's, well, it's not your job. How dare you question me like we have in healthcare? No, we're in this together. We cross-check, we cross-monitor, and we have a culture that supports that degree of questioning and collaboration. And when there is a setback, we learn from it. We commit it to a greater resiliency.